Chapter 5, The Economics of Predation. Bashing economists has become one of the most popular indoor sports. This sport goes on in most nations on the planet. The cause is real. Most of the world finds itself in dire economic conditions. The same economists who were so eager to take credit for the sunny days of industrial expansion following World War II have found their most basic premises under attack as the boom turned sour. Most Americans who took economics in college during the 1960s used a textbook written by a Nobel Memorial Prize-winning economist named Paul Samuelson. In fact, he won the prize in part for his textbook. In his 1961 edition, he wrote that the body of neoclassical theory is, quote, accepted in its broad outlines, but all but a few extreme left-wing or right-wing writers, close quote. This confidence borders on arrogance. The central currents of economic thought held such sway that someone could make such statements and be taken seriously. The economists believed that their understanding was so profound that the situation was under control and all that was necessary for them to do was fine-tune the economy. And in fact, during those days, most economies were performing better than at any time in history. It should be noted that the health of the economy probably had little to do with the prescription of those economists. During this period, Daniel Bell, an historian at Harvard, found himself so caught up in the spirit of the times that he announced that the problems of production had been solved. The industrial democracies had demonstrated their overwhelming technological prowess to such an extent that the time had come to quit the battle and march forward bravely into the post-industrial age, where the most important skill would be information processing. The concept of post-industrialization soon did a favor that far exceeded its worth as an idea. Post-industrialization assumes that because the number of persons employed in industrial occupations is shrinking, their activities are increasingly unimportant. Using straight-line trend projections, the post-industrialists seem to think that at some point the number of industrial activities will reach zero. As is obvious, this assumption is flawed to the point of absurdity. Because of this, the concept of post-industrialization has been so thoroughly diluted as to mean almost anything or nothing at all. As the economies of the world fell apart in the 1970s, the consensus in economic thought became fragmented. Now, not only were the fringe elements outside of the body of neoclassical thinking, but economics as a profession had found itself split into neo-Austrians, neo-institutionalists, neo-Marxists, Chicago Monetarists, and post-Keynesians, along with a host of backward-looking fundamentalists. This last group does not even feign any pretense at objectivity, but is only in the business of rationalizing privilege. Faltering economies promote unstable politics, and in country after country, voters, at least in those countries with voters, chose to try parties with alternate programs. The French voted in a socialist government that turned out to be Keynesian. The British replaced the Labour government with Thatcherism, a form of Chicago monetarism. The examples are too numerous to cite. All peoples with an opportunity have tried to change their governments on the promise that with a new government comes a new economic game plan. The result has been a period of economic experimentation almost without precedent. Virtually every form of capitalist economics has been tried somewhere in the world. Strangely, the most successful capitalist economies of Japan and Germany are not often imitated, and their economists do not win Nobel Prizes. The Marxist economists had an even more interesting conundrum. While gleefully pointing out the problems of capitalism, the problems of capitalism were their own. One of the articles of faith amongst the Marxists was that socialism is as superior to capitalism as capitalism was to feudalism. According to Marx, the only reason for capitalism to exist in a historical sense was that capitalism was the stage where the problems of production are solved. If the capitalist system breaks down because of problems in the systems of production, especially if the problem is a technological mismatch caused by the shifting realities of resource supply, for example, then any problem that appears in capitalism will eventually appear in the Marxist states. Although the Marxist states were known for many things, technological innovation was not one of them. Not only did the Marxist states fail to come up with an alternative industrial model for themselves, they were unable to execute the Western model. The closest comparison would have to be between East and West Germany. When the wall came down, the East Germans were making an ugly little car called the Wartburg, while the West Germans were making awe-inspiring vehicles like the BMW 750. In the body of Marxist thought, the problems of industrialization are dealt with only as a problem of social organization. An enormous contribution to the understanding of industrial problems, to be sure, but hardly the whole story. The technological and scientific problems of industrialization were beyond the expertise of Marx. He was neither an engineer or a natural scientist, so he put them in a kind of limbo where they have languished, much to the detriment of industrialization in the Marxist states. Of course, there are those who will claim, most notably the Trotskyites, that Marxism was never really tried anywhere in the world, and if it ever were to be, it would prove itself superior, especially if it had grown out of an advanced capitalist state as Marx had intended. Taking all the governments that claimed to be Marxist and assume that they were what they claimed to be, it would be fair to say that in many ways, especially technological, their economies had the same problems as those of the capitalist democracies. The stunning reality of all of this is that virtually all economists, Marxist and capitalist alike, lost their compasses simultaneously. Productivity growth was a problem in the former Soviet Union. They blamed corruption, obstructionist bureaucrats, or lack of market incentives. Productivity growth was a problem in the United States. The common explanation was lack of investment. Just at a time when the old pet theories of how the world works are failing economists in both East and West comes, of course, the calls for solutions. Economists the world over must be wishing they had not taken credit for the boom of the post-World War II period. Technically, of course, economists are supposed to be scientists. As scientists, their job is to describe the currents and motions of the economic activity around them, much as an astronomer charts the motion of the heavenly bodies. Compared to the astronomers, the job of the economists is infinitely more difficult. contrary to the most fond hopes of the most dedicated supporters of econometrics, human behavior is much too arbitrary to be modeled. Like the discovery of retrograde motion in the planets that led to the doubts about the model of the Earth as the center of the universe, so the shocks of the 70s and 80s have been to the economic models of industrialization. The distress shows in the titles of economic literature. What's wrong with economics? Economists at bay. Why economics is not yet a science, and dangerous currents, the state of economics, are all titles of the era. It is hard to predict anything if the models fail to define the current realities. Leaving aside the forecasting function, the study of economics is really a form of historical pulse-taking. The data examined by economists are at best a day old. Whatever an economist describes is something that has happened in the past. What this means is that millions of critical economic decisions have been made by quite ordinary citizens before the data gathering even begins. Not only are economists having a great deal of difficulty with the prescriptive function of their job, they are having problems with the descriptive element. The myth of the market. Belief in the notion of a free market is the distinguishing characteristic of the leisure class capitalist economist. More than that, in the United States, belief in the free market is the boundary definition of the economics profession. Those who doubt this basic thesis are cast out of the profession and are labeled economic philosophers, anthropologists, satirists, moral philosophers, or anything but economists. The notion of the free market is elevated to the status of untouchable scientific law because with it one can mathematically model human behavior. This ability to model human behavior is why economists believe themselves to be more scientific than their fellow social scientists. If the laws of supply and demand are not true, then economists fall back to the level of other mere social scientists. When the bright-eyed student arrives for the first economics class, the first item on the agenda is the parable of the free market. The story goes something like this. There is a fisher who goes to market with his catch. In order for him to sell all his fish, he must set a price low enough to clear out his fish stand by the end of the day. If he sets the price for the fish too low, he will not maximize his return. If he sets it too high, he will have fish left over at the end of the day, which will spoil and cause losses in that manner. To be successful in the marketplace, the fisher must get the highest possible price while still selling his entire catch. Of course, if other fishers had good catches and the market is flooded with fish, the price must fall because everyone will be trying to clear out supplies. If the fisher was the only one lucky enough on a bad day to have any fish to sell, he can raise his price to whatever level he chooses. This parable has a certain amount of believability. If the economics student goes down to the local fish market for several weeks in a row, he or she might just see this sort of supply-based price adjustment taking place. With this information, the student can return to the classroom secure in the knowledge that the market controls the price. If the level of supplies influences price and price influences demand, then there is a relationship between supply and demand that is predictable. If the economic student believes this parable of the free market law of supply and demand, the first big hurdle has been jumped on the way to becoming an economist. If the student happens to make the mistake of going down to the supermarket instead of the fish market, the likelihood that the parable of the free market will be confirmed diminishes rapidly. Certain products, like fresh blueberries, will conform to the laws of supply and demand, while others, like milk and cheese, seem exempt. Doubts will form because not all products seem to react to the same law. The student returns to class and these doubts are explained by, yes, milk prices are an exception that will be covered in a later chapter, but before understanding of something as arcane as milk price supports can be achieved, the basics must be learned. The student must be able to walk before running. Milk prices are an exception that proves the rule, but the laws of supply and demand work, the student is assured. The student could make another mistake of getting to the right fish market but talking to the wrong people, and stumble upon the fact that setting the correct price is not the only element in selling out all the catch. The wrong, in quotes, people to talk to would be the fishers themselves. If some fisher took the student into his confidence and told his tricks of the trade, the student might come up with questions his professor could not answer. If a student were to think about the market as a fisher instead of a budding economist, he or she might ask, "Suppose my fish were not selling well enough to clear out my fish stand by the end of the day, and I didn't want to lower my prices, would I have any alternatives?" Given the amount of exposure to sophisticated marketing techniques endured by the average economic students in any industrial society, the student could well come up with many alternatives gleaned from personal experience. Come up with enough plausible alternatives, and he or she will be doomed as an economic student. 1. The student fisherman might decide that the price he or she set for the fish was fine, but the sales location was bad. One alternative might be to find a friendlier spot in the fish market. 2. It might be decided the fish stand looked pretty ratty and needed to be scrubbed down and painted. 3. The sign could be enlarged. 4. A child could be employed as a barker. 5. The fisher could get fancy, rename his catch, and pass out exotic-sounding recipes. This, of course, is outside the economic rules because the customer is supposed to know enough about buying fish not to be fooled by such ploys. The historical fact is that when the North Atlantic cod fishers were suffering from an inability to market their catch, they renamed their cod, which is, after all, a very unappetizing sounding name for food, torsk, which sounds vaguely foreign and is another but unfamiliar name for cod. They printed recipes that touted torsk as the poor man's lobster and placed them next to the fish cases in the supermarkets. This marketing scheme was so effective that 25 years later, in some parts of the United States, though the various consumer agencies have forced the label of cod back into the frozen fillets, people still ask for torsk in the stores. Recipes in the newspaper food sections will include the term torsk along with the disclaimer that torsk is really North Atlantic cod. More interestingly, this was the first major inroad in the Midwestern American beef diet. fish was on its way to becoming a major dietary player. This example amply demonstrates that in many cases, markets are manufactured because demand is manufactured. 6. The fisher could decide that since business was slow, he could spend his time flaying the fish, so that instead of lowering the price of his fish, he would be raising the value. Of course, this is outside the supply and demand parable, because when the fisher fillets his catch, he is no longer in the whole fish business, but in the processed fish business. But modifying what has been gathered from nature is the most common feature of human endeavor. Placing such endeavors outside the parameters of the basic parable weakens its impact considerably. 7. The fisher might decide not to lower his price and give away what is left of his catch to the orphanage on his way home. He might reason that lowering the price can get to be a bad precedent. If the word gets out that the fisher always lowers his price at noon, folks will refuse to buy until he runs his clearance sale. The price must be kept up even if some of the catch goes home to the compost heap, because tomorrow's market prices must be considered as well. The only description for such behavior by economists would be irrational. A realization begins to gnaw at the student economist that the only form of human behavior allowed under the laws of supply and demand, the lowering of prices, is the last option. The real world fisher will try. It is in the interest of the real world fisher to do everything in his power to invalidate the very laws that are supposed to be so universal that mathematical models can be constructed around them. It probably occurs to the student economist that if the exemplary market of the parable can be manipulated, manufactured, altered, and circumvented in the real world by people who have real-world motivations for doing so, imagine what happens in the markets for more complex products. The parable of the fish market is so appealing to economists because it is so simple. Buyers and sellers in such a market have roughly the same amount of information and power. There is perfect competition and perfect knowledge. Renaming cod torsk may help people to try a fish they might not otherwise tried, but once they get into the habit of eating torsk, the laws of supply and demand would reassert themselves as folks made their buying decisions based on price. No matter what the fish is called, eventually the decision comes down to easily evaluated variables such as size, freshness, color, smell, and so on. Those who have the intelligence to feed themselves should be able to buy fish with as much skill as anyone else. It is possible, in economic terms, to have perfect knowledge of fish buying. It is also possible, in economic terms, to have a form of perfect competition if there are enough buyers and sellers. Fishing is a gathering occupation dating back before recorded history. For all practical purposes, people have always fished. Fish, with a few modern exceptions, are what they are without any intervention from humans. Humans can alter the shape of fish by crossbreeding, but fish are not something that humans create. Humans create automobiles. Humans cannot create fish. Because the forces involved with the creation of fish are superior to the forces mustered to create an automobile, the variations within species are so obvious and few that virtually any conscious human with any interest can master them. For reasons of setting price, Perfect knowledge is possible. Perfect knowledge is clearly not possible in the case of products made by humans. Comparing Cod A with Cod B is child's play compared with comparing Automobile A with Automobile. This is so because those who could have anything to do with making comparisons difficult have done everything in their power towards reaching the goal of making sure their products can only be compared with themselves. That is the whole point of modern industrial enterprise. Economists are, by definition, of the hunter leisure class when they assert that the gathering distribution parable of the free market has everything to do with the industrial economies of the 20th century. A person who tries to apply the lessons of the fish market to the problem of buying a car is confronted with the realization that perfect knowledge is not merely difficult, but impossible to obtain. If the leisure class economist goes to market to buy an automobile with the clear goal of keeping transportation costs per mile as low as possible, maximizing his utility, he will find the problem of comparison so difficult that a mathematical model of the comparison process probably will get him published in a scholarly economics journal. The person wanting to compare the cost of owning car A with car B must first come up with a working definition of the useful life of the purchase. One cannot evaluate the car as a whole, but only as a collection of individualized components. The car's useful life is ended when the buyer sells the car or when it is junked. If the buyer intends to sell the car at some future date, the cost per mile calculations must include projections of potential selling prices so as to account for depreciation. This is a form of forecasting that can be, at best, a version of trend projections based on historical data. A trip to the library can give the car buyer some idea of past depreciation rates of various automobiles, but there are complications to this data. If the buyer is thinking about a new model, past depreciation rates cannot be relied upon. If the buyer is thinking about an existing model with an established track record, the risk is that a new and superior model will be introduced before he sells and his purchase will have fallen from favor. Although the current depreciation rate may be true, it will be dramatically wrong in the future. If the decision is to keep this car until the wheels fall off, the buyer must consider future maintenance costs. Such calculations would include the price of spare parts, frequency of parts replacements, costs of labor, and the real life expectancy of irreplaceable parts. The buyer must understand that replacement parts will not always be available because either the car maker will go out of business or stay in business and halt spare parts production. Because of the difficulties in obtaining spare parts, keeping a 1932 Ford or a 1953 Studebaker running is an expensive hobby, not a low cost per mile form of transportation. But armed with these educated guesses, the buyer must be able to predict when the car will cost more to maintain than to replace to arrive at some form of useful life calculations. Having made an educated stab at depreciation and maintenance costs, the economist buyer can turn to the easier parts of the equation, like comparing fuel efficiency with purchase price. If fuel prices hold steady, a simple calculation can be made of how long it will take for an increased purchase price plus finance costs to be returned in fuel cost savings. Of course, since petroleum cannot be created, but only gathered and refined, it does conform to some of the laws of supply and demand that can be projected to fluctuate. The one law the economist buyer sincerely believes in is now threatening the easiest part of his calculations. Then, there are the esoteric calculations. What are childproof real door locks worth if they keep a child from falling out of a moving car? What are good seats worth if they keep the driver from getting a bad back? What are good brakes worth if they keep the car out of a fender bender? The future economic well-being of the economist buyer may well hinge on questions he is not in any position to ask, much less answer. The notion of perfect knowledge in an industrial setting is patently absurd, since perfect knowledge is a key underlying assumption of the free market parable. The notion of the free market in an industrial setting is equally absurd. Perfect knowledge and perfect competition are not the only forms of perfection in which the leisure class economists believe. Some adhere to the notion of the perfect labor market. The perfect labor market implies that all labor is the same and can be easily inserted or deleted wherever the need arises. Of course, the notion that an unemployed supermarket worker in New Jersey can become a systems computer designer in California without a huge investment of money, time, and effort means the perfect labor market idea is shot full of holes. One would think that the very word perfect would be enough to make the leisure class economist nervous, perfection being a rare commodity. Industrial minds believe in manufacturing tolerances, not perfection. They look at arguments with the word perfection in them as excuses to close the debate early. Who, after all, can argue with something that is perfect? The charge that economists use the words like science and perfect as smokescreens to hide much more questionable underlying assumptions is valid. Not all the smokescreens are deliberate efforts to deceive, however. Most are forms of confusion caused by bad reasoning, worse premises, word traps, irrelevant analogies, and lack of information. Confusion or deception, it matters not. The economics of predation. The ultimate failure of leisure class economics, however, is that it is a static system. The marketplace is a wonderful place to take an economic snapshot of current conditions, but as Lester Thoreau points out so magnificently in his book Dangerous Currents, there is no market between the present and the future. This is sufficient reasoning to reduce the notion of the market to its role in determining blueberry prices. The only valid statement that can be made about the future and the market is that the market will set the price of blueberries in the future. Nothing more. What is simply a minor oversight in an economic description of the market as a distribution system for gathered wealth becomes a fatal flaw when the same economics is applied to industrialization. In the gathering distribution economic market description, the creator is overlooked. How iron ore was formed is the province of geologists, or possibly the theologians, not economists. How it was formed is unimportant in the economic scheme of things compared to who owns it. Forgetting the creator may be a harmless mistake with iron ore, troubling mostly sentimental clergymen. Ignoring the creators of manufactured wealth and how they create it is to ignore most real economic activity in the industrial states. The world of the economic creator is not a static world. By its very nature, creativity is a dynamic activity. Static market considerations applied to creative industrial activity are simply inadequate. Moreover, creative industrial activity involves planning, the only bridge between the present and the future. As a result, market economics and planning are mutually exclusive. The result is quite amusing. Huge economic textbooks filled with laws, axioms, postulates, and other wise sayings from the static, simplistic view of the world devote only a few pages to the creative, dynamic side of the economy. Such attention is usually confined to an observation about research and development budgets, how appropriate and how much. Economists labor long and hard over the human behavior involved with dividing the pie, but ignore the human efforts to produce the pie itself. The myth of a value-free science. If economics is not the science it pretends to be, it must be something else. From the industrial point of view, economics looks like a form of religion, complete with articles of faith. The articles of faith of the hunter-leisure class make perfect sense in a predatory setting, but cannot stand up in a modern industrial setting and must be examined. Article of Faith number 1. It is possible to be rich when your neighbor is poor. "I'm all right, Jack," a British expression that covers this sentiment perfectly, conveys the hunter-leisure class feeling that survival is difficult enough without worrying about anyone else. This feeling is natural enough. For millions of years, people survived by looking out for themselves and their families before worrying about the problems of the rest of the clan. The great hunters prospered, the weak fell by the wayside. This is social Darwinism taken to its logical conclusion. In industrial economies, the problem is not so simple. There may exist a difference between rich and poor. Such differences seem inevitable. But if the differences between the rich and poor become too great, the mechanisms for becoming and staying rich disintegrate. In an industrial setting, the poor cannot become too poor because they lose their usefulness as consumers, and the industrial wheel slows down. Historically, this has been true. Panics, recessions, depressions, and other forms of industrial economic upheaval have followed great separations between the wealthy and the poor. On the other side of the coin, the societies with the smallest multiples between the best and worst paid members of society, like Japan, are the strongest industrially. There is also an aesthetic rejection to the possibility of being rich in a sea of poverty. How rich can a person be who must drive through a dirty, ugly slum, teeming with people who would kill him or kidnap his children? There must be more pleasurable lifestyles than living behind walls, bouncing around in an armored car, and sending the children to foreign countries for an education. This is how the rich live in Central America and South Africa. The whole point of colonialism and absentee landlordism is to avoid this problem. Move with the money to Switzerland or Palm Springs and leave the ugliness of poverty behind. Hire a bunch of predators to hunt down and kill anyone who disagrees with this arrangement, and it is possible, on a temporary basis, to be rich while your neighbor is poor. While excessive gaps between rich and poor merely push the industrial societies into recessions, huge income gaps in the states of neocolonial feudalism cause revolutions. It should also be noted that most real indicators of wealth are public. Having an expensive car is of very little use unless there are good roads to drive it on. This obvious point is lost on the predators who believe that wealth is strictly a private measure. Article Faith Number 2. Anything is permissible if it leads to your personal survival. When the fight was between humans armed with rocks and sticks and large and very dangerous animals, anything the human could think of was permissible. There were no ethics when cornered by a bear. Correct that. There was one ethic. Get out of the corner alive, and if there are bear steaks for dinner, so much the better. The problem is that industrialization has enlarged the definition of anything. From thumb screws to the rack, from Auschwitz to the atomic bomb, humans have become increasingly barbaric as their possibilities for barbarism increase. A perfectly useful survival instinct of the hunter class can lead to perfectly awful behavior. Personal survival as an economic rationalization causes serious problems and even more serious failures of understanding. The real reason economics is called value-free is because economists refuse to make any judgments about any form of human behavior which enhances the survival of the perpetrator. An economist will not differentiate between the economic activity of a hostile leverage buyout and the activity surrounding the initial public stock offering of an emerging company. If the numbers are the same, the two activities are considered economically equivalent, even though from an industrial point of view, the two activities are as different as death and birth. If the economist does not understand the difference between industrial death and birth, all the numbers are absolutely worthless. Article of Faith Number 3. Personal profit at the expense of the common good is virtuous behavior. Insofar as the leisure class is concerned, there is no common good. Resources are limited, and the struggle to get a piece belongs to the strong and the shrewd. The winners get to propagate, write history, and be admired. It's a jungle out there. It's the survival of the fittest. It is perfectly understandable that a hunter leisure class mentality fails to recognize the notion of a common good. The most obvious common good, the biosphere, cannot be damaged except with the help of the industrial class. Predation only leads to the survival of the fittest, an arguable good. Destruction of the biosphere is a leisure class problem only because the industrial class has made the problem possible. Economists have few conceptual tools to deal with predatory behavior contributing to the problem of a deteriorating biosphere. Whatever problems predatory behavior has caused throughout the bulk of history, destruction of the biosphere has not been one of them. Of course, this is no longer true. Predatory behavior combined with the possibilities offered by industrialization can cause incredible, if not irreparable, damage. If maximizing profits is the goal, how can there be room to trade profits for an improved biosphere or any other form of common good? Pathetic attempts to place a price on clean air and water have only demonstrated the economist's dilemma. At best, the economist can recommend charitable contributions that fit well within the framework of noble generosity. The industrial class must believe in the notion of the common good by the very nature of their work. Large-scale projects depend on collective action. Not only must there be an intense amount of cooperation among players, but the players must have the minimum number of distractions. If the players are hungry when they work, they will think about their hunger instead of their work. Satisfied, well-fed, and prosperous workers will always do better work than their dissatisfied, hungry, and impoverished counterparts. Technologically simple, though large tasks, like the building of the pyramids or the Great Wall of China, can be accomplished with forced labor. In point of fact, most of the producing class throughout history have been slaves. But forced labor never produced the artificial heart valve or the microchip. The higher the general level of prosperity, the greater number of potential industrial superplayers, and the greater chance for high technical achievement. Meritorious reward schemes are necessary prerequisites for industrial success, but even the most enlightened industrial enterprise falls strangely silent when the notion of the common good extends to the preservation of the biosphere. Even if an economist can escape the trap set out by these three very questionable articles of faith, other pitfalls await. Modern corollaries to these postulates mask the Hunter roots for a contemporary audience. Consider the very contemporary notion that the success of an enterprise is tied to its profitability. All profitable activities are successes, while unprofitable activities are failures. The problem of assessing the success or failure of an enterprise based on its profitability is that the very concept of what is profitable masks a very great many value assumptions. Not everything worth doing is profitable. Not everything that is profitable is worth doing. Raising children, cooking meals for friends, planting trees, and reading books are all examples of worthwhile activities that are almost never profitable. In contrast, selling booze to alcoholics or guns to criminals is almost always profitable, but never worth doing. Moreover, there is a very large problem of defining profitability. The figure a man claims is profit from an enterprise is rarely the same figure if the listener is the tax examiner or a woman he's trying to impress. Stockholders are given glowing reports, while union heads hear dismal reports. The more ways an accountant can arrange the same figures, the greater his worth. The only subject other than profits more likely to be the object of creative writing in fiction is profit projections. Even if some measure of honesty and objectivity could be brought to the subject of profitability, profits are an extremely fuzzy notion because of their definitive predatory nature. Profits are often merely those costs that can be shoved onto someone else. Many profitable enterprises would become unprofitable if they were forced to pay to clean the water they need and return it to its original state when they finished with it. Many operations are profitable because they fail to spend for maintenance, a short-term gain in return for long-term decline. Marx claimed that profits came from paying employees less than they were worth, but inequitable transactions with the planet and with the future are just as important, if not more so, to a working definition of profits. Profitable enterprises that pay all employees living wages do not degrade but improve the environment while investing and maintaining the operation for future use are extremely rare, possibly non-existent. The subject of profits inevitably leads to a discussion of money. Economists love to discuss money. Money can be counted and the flow of money can be traced. But discussions of money shroud the greatest of all weaknesses in economics. By the time wealth has been defined in monetary terms, most of the interesting economic arguments have already been decided. Econometric forecasting, the highest flowering of 20th century leisure class economics, is merely the computer-assisted mathematical manipulations of the numbers represented by money. Econometrics is fatally flawed because it tracks money and not wealth. Since mathematics is an abstraction and money is an abstraction, mathematically tracking the flow of money is a compound abstraction. Using econometricians' mathematical model to describe the wealth of a nation or any of its subparts is a process akin to reading a description about a set of blueprints for a building and arriving at a judgment about the real building. It is no wonder that the most complex and scientific-looking models of econometricians are about as useful and accurate as a handful of darts and a dartboard. Economics passes as a science by virtue of its great powers of quantification. It turns out that counting money does not quantify much. When the disciple Paul claimed that the love of money was the root of all evil, he was probably correct. Anyone who can love something as intrinsically nonsensical as money is prone to other forms of psychotic behavior. Money is not wealth, but a symbol for wealth. After all, money is nothing more than funny-shaped pieces of metal, colorfully engraved pieces of paper, or more commonly in the 20th century, plus or minus charges of electricity in the core memory unit of some bank's computer. None of these items has much intrinsic value. Gold has some interesting industrial applications, but a handful, truckful, of paper currency could be burned for warmth, but generally speaking, the value of money has nothing to do with its intrinsic worth. An extreme but illuminating example of the value of money is shown by the dilemma faced by two men in a desert. One has a jug of water, the other has a 5-pound bar of gold bullion representing money. The only way the man with the water will exchange for the gold is if he thinks he can have both the gold and his survival as well. He knows a shortcut out of the desert, or knows where there is some more water the fellow with the gold doesn't know about. If, however, the man with the water comes to the conclusion that without the water he will die, it is very likely that although he would very much like the 5-pound bar of gold, the jug of water means more to him and he will not trade for the gold. Both the man with the gold and the man with the water have come to the same conclusion. In this particular social setting, a jug of water is more valuable than a 5-pound bar of gold. This is true even though both men know that just 100 miles away in another social setting, where water is so plentiful that a gold bar could be exchanged for thousands of jugs of water, neither would even think about trading the gold bar for a jug of water. The social convention is so strong that such a trade would be considered a form of madness. Economists justify the social convention based on the concept of scarcity. In most places, water is plentiful and gold is scarce. Therefore, water is less valuable than gold. But a jug of water in the middle of a desert is as scarce as the gold bar in settled locations. When money and water are equally scarce, water is valued over money because water has intrinsic value and the money does not. In the context of the desert, both men agree that the man with the water is wealthier than the man with the gold. Wealth and money are not the same thing. But so long as the social conditions are agreeable, people can be made to believe they are equivalent and convertible. Those who believe that the person who would take the gold and die in the desert is a fool should consider the current debate over acid rain. In a very real sense, water is being exchanged for money. Some wunderkind in the Office of Management and Budget of the United States, no doubt the same person who came up with the concept of ketchup as a vegetable, figured that stopping acid rain would cost over $6,000 per fish saved. Water supports more than the lives of fish, and clean water is very rare. Moreover, the nearest source of water, besides the one we have, is a great deal further away than the edge of a desert. The distance must be measured in light years. Worse than that, the water is not being transmuted into any sort of precious metal such as gold, but into a form of money that is nothing more than rearranged electrons in a computer. The environment is an actor in all conversions, and the failure to take it into account in any social system of wealth convertibility is a serious error. Money cannot be valuable or worthless. Trading or speculation of money in a commodity market has never solved the problem of describing the value of money accurately. In fact, since scarcity or its lack is always an artificial or man-made phenomena when the commodity is money, the market in money is always more irrational and volatile than any other commodity. Make a market irrational and volatile, and the markets will be corruptible. Volatile and irrational markets, even without corruption, are essentially anti-industrial. Industrial wealth takes long lead times to create. Arbitrary changes in the rules governing money can and have short-circuited the creation of real industrial wealth. If money games cause the real diminution of industrial wealth, the confusion of money and wealth can cause real but unnecessary declines in the general standards of living for everyone. Because industrial wealth takes a long time to build and, once built, acquires an inertia that can survive some battering, money games exact a serious toll long before the money players notice that the real wealth behind the money they have been playing with is no longer there. Industrial distress precedes monetary distress. Even if an economist abhors the money markets as a system of predatory exploit, the confusion of money and wealth can persist. Wealth, especially industrial wealth, is a subject almost beyond comprehension, much less definition. But until the economist understands the nature of industrial wealth, he is stuck with pre-industrial models to describe industrial economies. At best, the economist will be able to discuss the social arrangements of how the economic pie is divided, not the much more interesting issue of how the pie got there in the first place, and how big the pie is going to be. From an industrial point of view, this is an exercise in missing the whole point.